sit, it's a win-win, cheek to cheek. We hold hands like it's 1915. I only wish for you to be so happy. You would turn the favor right back to me. And oh, it's incredible. Never thought that it would be so beautiful. But our love, it's incredible.
This is Transmissions from Plot. You're listening to Transmissions from Plot, a collaborative broadcast between Access Gallery and CITR 101.9 FM that takes a closer look at Access Gallery's exhibitions and programs through interviews, discussion, and soundworks. I'm Catherine DeMontre, Projects Coordinator at Access Gallery, and I will be your host for today. In the first episode, we have compiled a series of conversations between myself and the four artists whose works are currently on display at Access Gallery as part of the 23 Days at Sea Chapter 2 exhibition. 23 Days at Sea is an artist residency program and curatorial project developed by director-curator Kimberly Phillips for Access Gallery in partnership with the Burrard Arts Foundation and the Contemporary Art Gallery in Vancouver. For the residency, we sent artists aboard cargo ships sailing from Vancouver across the Pacific Ocean to Shanghai. Each voyage took approximately 23 days, during which time the artists were considered to be in residence aboard the vessel. The resident artists were charged with generating a new body of work in response to the voyage, as well as producing a logbook to record their crossing. To quote Kimberly Phillips, "The idea for this residency project was originally provoked in part by the fact that Access Gallery is a small publicly funded organization based in a city whose notorious real estate market renders the spatial demands of a traditional residency untenable. So instead, we sent them out to sea. Over the next hour, we've included conversations between the artists who are a part of Chapter 2 of this project, Rebecca Moss, Sikarnt Skulisariaporn, Michael Driebert, and Lily Huston Herderick. First, we have a recording of my conversation with Rebecca and Sikarnt on site in the gallery the day before their exhibition opening with us. So, I have a very jet-lagged Rebecca Moss here, as well as Sikarnt Skulisariaporn. They're two of our artists in 23 Days at Sea, Chapter 2, the exhibition that we're having at Access Gallery. Rebecca has just flown in from London this week to attend the exhibition, and Sikarnt has been in Vancouver for just over a month, undergoing a secondary residency program with the Contemporary Art Gallery at their Burrard Fieldhouse location. That's following her voyage across the Pacific. So maybe I'll start with Rebecca. For those who didn't hear about this last year, Rebecca was aboard the Hanjin Geneva last August and September, during which time the Hanjin Shipping Corporation went bankrupt. So at that time, Hanjin was the seventh largest shipping company in the world, so this had some massive implications for many of the people on land and at sea who are dependent on the smooth efficiency of this system. Hundreds of ships were at sea at that time, full of commodity goods, and as a result of the bankruptcy, the ships were not permitted to berth at any ports. So Rebecca and the crew of the Hanjin Geneva were stuck at sea for nearly three additional weeks while Hanjin sorted out their business. So Rebecca, I'm sure you've talked about this a million times now, but maybe you could briefly give us some context to the situation you found yourself in last year.
Okay, so I set sail on the 23rd of August, and then on the 31st of August, over breakfast, the captain announced to me that Hanjin had gone bankrupt, and that basically meant that a couple of days later we had to drop anchor 12 miles off of the coast of Japan and we just had to sit and wait for further instruction, but we had no idea when we were going to get back to port, back to land at all. And eventually I got into port in Tokyo on the 17th of September.
So this time last year you were still waiting?
I was literally sitting on a boat this time last year, waiting.
Looking at the coast of
Japan. I could see it from where I was sitting. I could see all of the wind turbines on the coast. I could see buildings. We were it felt like we were really close. It felt like I could get out and swim. But, yeah, lots of sharks, so definitely not advisable.
And sea snakes, I hear.
And sea snakes, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a broad question, so maybe just more of a talking point, but I'm curious about how you, in your mind, think about the 23 days at sea residency experience in relation to the current economic and political climate. So what role did you feel you had as a passenger and as an artist specifically, and in observation of this system that often remains invisible to the majority of people?
I think that all of the artists involved in this project feel responsibility in some way to make visible things that were previously invisible. And to, I mean, I'm not that sort of well-versed in economics, so the way that I tell my story will be from the perspective of an artist, and hopefully can make these experiences and this strange world feel more accessible for people. But also my position on the boat, I was obviously in a position of privilege, and I felt that very strongly because I wasn't worried about job security, whereas the captain and the crew were understandably very concerned about job security, and they didn't want to be too vocal in being too critical of the industry, whereas being an artist, you're very free to express opinions on these things.
Yeah, I was going to bring up that point because in the logbook you produced for Access Gallery, you mentioned that privilege as you're on this vessel alongside laborers who have legitimate concerns about their future and their job security. And even just in the media around that time, they zeroed in on you quite a bit. Like, in some cases as artists, this kind of happens. And meanwhile, during this experience, there were hundreds and maybe thousands of Hanjin employees in similar or worse conditions than what you were in on your ship, and they definitely weren't given the same kind of media attention, so you kind of became this voice that people were paying attention to, and I was just wondering if this has left you with any new queries about the role of being an artist today, or if that's affected your artistic practice since then.
I think that I really value art activity and art practices that go out into the real world and try to engage with, I don't know, industries and lives and sort of situations that previously maybe wouldn't have necessarily crossed people's minds. So I think that I really value art activity that goes out into the field. But going back to what you just said about being in a privileged position on the boat, I'm sure being white, British and young and female was, you know, it's a very attractive story for the media to kind of tell this stranded young woman at sea.
Damsel in distress.
Exactly, damsel in distress. And I did actually have lots of messages from guys around the world wanting to come and rescue me, which was quite surreal. Complete strangers just sending me these messages, just like, you know, you seem really lonely and sad. Can, you know, shall I keep you company? Just things like this.
Oh,
it was really, it was really strange.
They're going to jump on their boat and come pick you up off the boat or something?
Well, that was one of the surreal things about having an internet connection. So there were two ways that I connected to the internet while I was trapped at sea. The first one was using the ship's email server, which is like a really, really sort of old fashioned, I'm sure Sukant had the same thing maybe, like a ship's email address where you log in and then you can only sort of send emails backwards and forwards. But I also could connect to mobile data because I was so close to Japan. I could buy mobile data from my position and kind of walk around the boat and find spots where you can actually get some signal.
Right.
And because of this, I was partially aware of all the hysteria that was happening outside of the situation, but it was only when I got off of the ship that I realised just the scale of it.
Yeah.
But just enough internet connection that I was able to receive strange messages.
That's actually this kind of a question I can direct to Sukarnt as well, and I'm wondering if it's this experience has left you with any new questions about your role as an artist? If you had certain expectations that shifted while you were on board?
Well, first of all, I always feel that I'm a privilege, like, as an artist, always, like, you know, educated from art school and talking about these kind of issues in the world that I'm actually not sort of facing as other people are. But then being on the ship kind of take it into another level in a way, because it's like these kind of people, like, as I told Rebecca, that I would sort of never have a chance to get to know or be in contact with, like, as a kind of in the same circle. Kind of the situation in this ship sort of makes it possible, because you have to keep seeing each other every day for, like, almost a month, and then you have to start, like, getting familiar with each other and stuff. So it's kind of a really, really new experience, a new way of relating with people to me, I guess. The thing that really comes to me when I was on the ship is mainly alienation in many, many ways, like alienated from land, from time, from the kind of connection between society, or like the sense that is made on land doesn't sort of make sense on the ship. We have our own clock, our own time and stuff, which is like only us synchronized between each other and not the land. And I guess that's also alienation in a sense of the kind of life of the seaman that facilitates this global capitalism, but not really being visible in the system or whatsoever. So I sort of, I guess I made the connection between these two, between alienated in space and time and alienated labor in global capitalism.
Yeah, and Kimberly talks about that a lot in her curatorial statements, about this invisibility and concealment that happens for how a lot of our goods are shipped around. Like, you might know that your shirt was made in Bangladesh, but the processes of getting it to you are often quite obscured and quite abstract, and so it's a really unique position that you guys get as passengers on these boats.
Yeah, the thing about container is it's like, sorry, but it's really fascinating that it's kind of very generic, like it's kind of geometrical metal shaped.
Very efficient. No
one. Streamlined.
Even the person who is like super, super close to it, have touched it whatsoever, wouldn't really have no idea what is inside. Like, it can be human, it can be trash, it can be like any kind. So it's kind of, in a way, as an artist, that is sort of exciting in a way that it's
still a bit mysterious, even though you're right there in front of it.
it feeds into imagination and stuff, but that's also part of the luxury of being an artist in a way, I guess. Yeah.
Rebecca, you also talk about the life of commodity objects and these containers, and when the Hanjin Geneva was at anchor, it seems like the goods began to sort of exceed the boundaries that they had been put in these efficient, streamlined containers. And maybe I'll let you talk about it, but just these, like, chickpeas and the brown ooze.
I think one thing that really struck me the longer that I was on the ship was that these anonymous containers began to feel a lot less anonymous, and the materials inside the containers began to exceed the boundaries of this anonymity and this mysteriousness. So chickpeas fell out and landed all over the deck, and there was actually a very small, like, little bird that had hopped on in Vancouver and had travelled with me the entire journey. It appears in the film towards the end that I've made for this show. But the bird was delighted about these little chickpeas, but that's one example. And there were animal skins, and all of this, like, brown seepage started kind of trickling down the walls and all over the upper deck, and it smelled really, it was a smell that would really, like, catch in your throat. And I was thinking a lot about the materiality of the ship. I was thinking about rust, and I was thinking about the kind of general filthiness of it, and the how old it felt, and the physicality of the ship. And I was thinking about how I was really interested in this idea of this rich materiality as resistance towards this streamlined shipping industry. And that for me felt like a really interesting philosophical sort of realization for myself with my work. And this kind of ties into my original proposal for this residency. I was looking at the writing of the French philosopher Henri Bergson.
Yeah.
Terrible pronunciation. He talks about this idea of laughter as being this sort of bodily rupture of a mechanized society. So the moment that we laugh, it's this sort of burst of humanity into this sort of streamlined mechanized system. And I think that the idea of laughter is this bodily response to something, and tying that into materiality and an embodied way of experiencing this story, it all seemed really connected in my mind. And it's sort of, the physicality, the dumb physicality of this boat stuck at sea.
Yeah, the way this residency is set up makes for a really direct relationship between the artist and these mechanical structures. And Sukarnt, before you left, you were gathering quite a bit of materials for reading and researching, and Sukarnt stayed with me before she boarded the ship, and I got to see this kind of frantic downloading of books and films and just resources, because she knew that her internet access was going to be so limited. And I was just wondering how relevant this preparation ended up being while you were actually on the ship, or if that changed at all.
That's really cool. It's totally irrelevant, for sure. Well, yeah, I barely use those things. I mean, I would, if I could choose, I would still do it again, because it gives me a peace of mind.
Yeah.
That's the thing with being a human in, you know, this kind of hyper-circulation that we are in, I guess, once we know that we are going to be disconnected, it's like freaking out and, yeah.
As one last talking point, as women who went on this trip, we've talked a little bit about this kind of macho masculine experience that you guys were immersed in, and this idea of, you know, the man at sea adventuring. And Sukarnt, you were the only female on the entire ship, and Rebecca, there was a few other women?
Yeah, there was another female passenger from Seattle. And there were two female crew members.
Okay, there was
a very impressive and remarkable young woman on my ship called Kat, and I sort of was really good friends with Kat on the ship.
Nice.
She expressed her ambition to become a captain one day. She was a few years younger than me, so I'm 26, and I was 25 at the time of the residency. And so Kat would have been maybe, I think, 22 or something like this. Mm. I spoke to her a little bit about, you know, had she experienced sexism and what was her experiences, and she said no, she hadn't. My experiences of being on board the ship, as I've spoken to you guys about earlier a little bit, from day one, my nickname was the Princess. There were two other passengers, John and Gail, and they were called Grandma and Grandpa, and I was called the Princess. So we all kind of got nicknames from day one, and I did experience a few sort of hints of sexism here and there. But I think just talking about power in general in this industry is really super interesting, and something that I'm trying to unravel for myself, because on the ship, yes, I might have experienced some bits of sexism, but at the same time, it goes back to this idea of privilege, because at the end of the day, I felt strangely protective of all of these men in this situation, because there are thousands of people, overwhelmingly male, but there are thousands of these people who are vulnerable within this big global system. And in a strange way, even though I might experience a bit of sexism here and there, they were ultimately in a very vulnerable position. So figuring out the power structure on board, it was funny because I felt like I didn't quite fit in anywhere. I was kind of incongruous, because I'm sure it was the same on your ship, Sukarnt. It was very, there was a very strict hierarchy. So you have the captain and then you have, like, you know, chief engineer, chief mechanic, etc. And then the passengers are this kind of like separate ambiguous table. And that was where I was sitting with John and Gail, the two other passengers. And I think that sort of figuring out where I sat within that hierarchy, but also within the sort of wider system, was really interesting. And still something that I'm not quite sort of, something that I haven't quite unraveled in my own head yet.
And so Karen, you were mentioning the sort of militaristic structure of it on your ship.
Yeah, I guess what I mean is that, you know, they have faith in this hierarchy, and they believe that they have to stick to it in order for everything to work, in order for the ship to go forward. So I guess as the same as what Rebecca said, like I also have this feeling that I'm not addressing this hierarchy, and so just like some extra particles just like can float around anywhere. Why other people have to be in the hierarchy, because otherwise the system would collapse. I feel like that's how they think about it. So yeah, I was also very interested in this position, and also as a kind of non-white as well, which is like a bit weird, because I feel like even though I'm, you know, like my appearance is Asian, but I also feel that I'm there as a kind of white privilege in a way, like, but yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this also because I've been living abroad and sort of like not totally fit in as a kind of like feeling like I'm a local or anything in Europe, but also not totally like super super Asian. So over there I have like a bit of articulation on my position as this kind of person in between culture as well as this kind of in between the hierarchies, I think.
I was told some people in the shipping industry believe, some of the crew on these ships, they believe that it's unlucky to have women on board or plants.
Well,
did you get told that?
No.
Women and plants, apparently. It's like a superstition. That some of them are very... Were your crew superstitious?
Yeah.
Really superstitious.
Highly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I got stuck at sea, like our ship became bankrupt, so maybe it is.
Yeah.
Maybe there's actually science in it.
Let's not go there.
We have both plants and women on the ship, actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Maybe it's cancel each other off.
But you... Yeah, maybe.
You're listening to Transmissions from Plot, a collaborative broadcast between Access Gallery and CITR 101.9 FM that takes a closer look at Access Gallery's exhibitions and programs through interviews, discussion, and soundworks. Throughout this episode, we have been playing audio from Lily Huston Hardwick's sound piece, Borrowed Time, a 3-hour, 53-minute soundwork that is playing in the gallery as part of the exhibition. I'll be talking later on about this with Lily, but first we're going to play back a recording of a conversation I had with Michael Driebert out at New Brighton Beach. Michael has been spending each day of the duration of the exhibition out at several beaches around Vancouver picking up garbage as part of his work for the 23 Days at Sea Chapter 2 exhibition, titled Purple Shells, Movement No. 2, Cleaning. In this recording, Michael explains the premise of this work and discusses invasive species, ideas around the act of returning, and of Purple Shells, Movements 1 and 2, in the larger context of his artistic practice. So I'm here at New Brighton Beach with Michael Driebert. Michael is here as part of his work for the 23 Days at Sea Chapter 2 exhibition, where he's enacting his work titled Movement No. 2, Cleaning. So Michael was our sixth artist in residence, boarding the CMA CGM Rigoletto on May 4th and disembarking in Ningbo, China on May 27th of this past year. So we already sort of chatted about this, but maybe you could start off the conversation by introducing your work, this work, and the context as to why you're here at New Brighton.
Okay, sure. Well, today we're here because it's something that I set out to do at the beginning of this exhibition, which is to visit beaches on a daily basis to pick up trash. In a nutshell, that's what I've been doing most days, or every day that I can. And I'm doing that because previous to this residency that I went on, I'd been collecting these purple shells. I didn't know the name of them. They're just all these, you know, to my eye, beautiful dots of purple all over beaches around Vancouver and Vancouver Island, and I just started collecting them because I liked them. And so I had quite a collection, and then this residency opportunity came along, and I did some more research on the shells and found out that, well, the shells aren't indigenous to this area. They're actually from Japan and China and Taiwan, and came over in their larval stage in the ballasts of cargo ships, and it's thought that they were originally deposited right here in Vancouver Harbour, and then conditions were kind of perfect for them to flourish, and they did, and they've migrated all the way as far north, I think, as the Brooks Peninsula on Vancouver Island, and as far south as somewhere in Oregon. But with the residency opportunity, I thought, wow, I'm going to take my collection of shells and essentially repatriate them back to their native land. So I liked the calcarific nature of the shells. They kind of remind me of bones, and I had all these like purple bones with me. And so I took the bones of these clams, and as we approached those waters, I just started scattering them every day as the ship kind of proceeded south to Ningbo, where I disembarked. Sort of just returning the bones of these shells to their ancestral land. That was kind of the idea, but, you know, on a more sort of visceral level, I just loved the opportunity to have these shells with me in a different context. And it just, the feeling of going towards that area by ship just heightened the whole experience of thinking about the history, the natural history of these shells, my relationship to them. So far, they seem to be co-occurring with the other mollusks and other sea life in the intertidal zone just fine. And in fact, there's, to this date, there doesn't seem to be any negative impacts. That might come out, but from the sort of scientific papers and theses that I've read, not so much yet.
I guess it's interesting thinking about them, like these invasive species, not actually, or non-native species not being actually damaging to its new environment, and thinking about species migrating across continents and moving in, human impact on that. And so you got to be on this ship that is part of a system that's directly involved in that, and I wonder how your relationship on this, within this system as a passenger aboard one of these boats, has played into the work that you're doing now here on the beach.
When I returned back to Vancouver, there was an opportunity to further the work that I did on the cargo ship, and show something or present something here in Vancouver, you know, in response to that activity. And I continued to visit the beaches where I initially collected those shells. And really, the thing that came forward the strongest was just a desire to try to offer something for the clams themselves. And it, you know, I didn't care to start doing even more, you know, I felt like I could go into this quagmire of like scientific research and study based on what would a clam want, but really I thought that would be ridiculous, and this is not my place, and it's not good, it just isn't my interest in, but my interest really is in my actual bodily experience of a place. You know, ultimately that's kind of why I do what I do. And so I just started noticing all the trash, and I thought, oh, well, that's really quite simple for me. You know, you just start picking up trash, and like anything that I kind of tend to get involved in, it's just kind of one thing leading to the next. And so I thought, well, I think what I'd like to do is use the container of picking up trash on a daily basis as a way to, you know, further my relationship to these places, to my feelings or thoughts around the clams, and also as a way to contain an interest in doing something even more, like after this exhibition. And so then the feeling to pick up trash just kind of came from a sort of a desire to somehow do something more reciprocal for the actual health or well-being of these clams.
Mm. We're watching a yellow lace chip bag wash ashore at the moment.
Yes.
Scoping it out. One thing about your work aboard the ship, so movement number one, returning, it's quite reminiscent of a 2011 work of yours, the Kamakura, in which you were given a glass float, a Japanese fishnet float from Haida Gwaii, which had floated across the Pacific. And then, so Michael brought this float back to the city of Kamakura, Japan, and gifted it to a local fisherman. So this work, or the work aboard the ship, follows a similar format to this, though it's fulfilling a different set of concerns and questions, definitely related more closely to the natural world and migration of species across geographies. Could you just talk a bit about this notion of returning and how it comes up frequently in your work?
It just reminds me of how much I love to, if I'm away from home, how much I love to return home. Mm. I wonder if a lot of these things that I do comes from that place of wanting to go to somewhere familiar again. And as much as it is exciting and interesting to go off somewhere to explore, it is just so nourishing. And I require the sort of the return back home as a way to just get re-energized. And so I wonder if I do these sorts of returnings and sort of cyclical activities just because I, in my own body, know how much I love to return back to where I am most familiar. And I think I relate to all these things probably most on that level. My body and how it feels to come home to a place that maybe I'm in love with, that I'm trying to take responsibility for. And then I think of something like a glass, Japanese glass fishnet float. And I perhaps anthropomorphize that ball, and I imagine myself on some kind of journey, and I think, well, you know, the purpose of me returning this ball really is, you know, for the human community. You know, it's to maybe just further this experience of nourishing one's place in the world, one's home, and by doing it, it kind of heightens that sort of curiosity and also real, like, phenomenological experience of my body coming home. But then, in the case of that work, Kamakura, my body taking this ball home. And then all of the sort of interesting, sometimes very difficult experiences along the way as well, of trying to return something home. It's also in the line of what you could call pilgrimage or something like that,
yeah.
Although that doesn't fit quite neatly. But I think there's something there as well, just a love of some sort of duty or excuse to go on a journey.
Right. And how was the glass ball received by the fishermen?
Oh, yeah, well... Ultimately, it was a very emotional exchange, actually, and I couldn't have predicted that. Maybe because the journey was, in my feeling, so grand, and also I don't think we have time to go into it, but my difficulties when I was in Tokyo trying to find people who fished, and then having to leave Tokyo to look for a fishing village nearby, there was just... there's a lot of anxiety in that experience. But
so you didn't have a fisherman in mind before you went?
No, I. It was just a. It was a, whim, you know. Right. It was just a hope and a whim to go and find someone. But I spent some time in Tokyo, and that's just not the place where people who fish live. And I learned that you have to go to somewhere else. And so I went to Kamakura and just had the sort of most wonderful of experiences of actually going fishing, fishing with a person, and then gifting the ball to him and his family. And could never have predicted that. Could have been where it wasn't such an emotionally active and dramatic sort of experience. Sometimes it's not like that at all. Sometimes things don't work out the way I planned them, but that did.
I just had one more question related to New Brighton Beach, and since you've been coming here almost every day, have you noticed any patterns with the garbage, like either quantity or type or texture or quality? Have you noticed anything like that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I was thinking about that last night, and actually somebody today asked me that question, and I think I've always noticed things, the things that show up, because you could clean a beach, but then the next day there will be just as much debris, and so stuff that floats is often what gets washed up. So styrofoam, as you can imagine, is probably the number one thing that I find. Bits of cellophane, rope, like plastic rope, just little bits of plastic here and there. Just a constant deposit of that kind of stuff on the beaches.
So it kind of follows the tides, I guess.
It's when I'm collecting the stuff, I don't really have it's interesting, I don't have like a strong feeling towards it. I have some sort of like a weird empathy towards these bits. They just seem so homeless, and so like they're not sure of themselves, and it's not really their fault in a way or something. It's a funny kind of experience, and maybe that's just me, but I go about and I collect the stuff, because you know, to my eye, it just doesn't belong here, and I know that this stuff gets eaten by seabirds and other sea life around here, and that's not good. And so it's a small, it's a really small part to play, but you know, I do it because I think it's important to do something like this for an area that I love, but it leads to the next thing. And I think that is the most vital reason why I do anything like this, because it's just always leading to the next and to the next. And if I don't do one thing, no matter how insignificant it is or feels, I won't do really anything at all. And I think that's why I do what I do.
I think that's a good place to end.
Great.
Awesome.
That's so nice. I appreciate the...
You're listening to Transmissions from Plot, a collaborative broadcast between Access Gallery and CITR 101.9 FM that takes a closer look at Access Gallery's exhibitions and programs through interviews, discussion, and soundworks. Lastly, Lily and I were finally able to catch up with one another across a few time zones to have a conversation over the phone in studio here. We'll cue that up now. So Lily is here with us over the phone from Rotterdam. She moved there recently to do her graduate studies at the Piet Zwart Institute and has made some time to chat with me today, so thank you. Lily was our 7th artist in residence and departed from Vancouver this past May 26th on the CMA CGM Fidelio, arriving in Ningbo, China on June 20th of this year. So Lily currently has two works at Access Gallery as part of her exhibition, one being a sound work titled Borrowed Time, which we have been playing throughout our broadcast, as well as a textile installation titled A Two-Top Set for One. So first of all, I wanted to say I've been listening to your 3-hour, 53-minute sound piece many times now sitting in the gallery. And throughout my day there, the audio meanders through karaoke songs to the sound of the ship's engine to exercising on the treadmill, along with clips from various pop songs and you singing along to those pop songs. These clips document a lot of the special and unspecial day-to-day happenings on board the cargo ship. I wanted to just ask what your process was like, first in choosing when to turn your recording device on, and secondly, how you made decisions selecting what made the cut for your final work.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, first of all, for having me on. I'm really happy to be sharing a little bit more about the project in a different format other than exhibition or also in text. It's really nice. I guess we can start with how I had originally intended to produce a work while on board CMA CGM Fidelio, because it was actually quite different to what ended up happening. So I had initially proposed to the gallery to use the time to record an album of sea shanties.
Great.
And I spent, yeah, and so I spent, and I had never, I never produced, I mean, I sing privately, but I'd never, you know, first of all, never produced a sound work, and then also never implicated my voice in my work before. So it was a whole new way of working. I was really excited about it being immaterial, about sort of not having a studio, but rather having this this space that was also also a strange sort of immaterial space, non-space, that was constantly in transit. So I spent a lot of time researching sea songs from different cultures and histories. I was looking at like Chinese fishing songs and Mississippi sounding calls and sort of your classic British and Irish shanties and pearl diver songs from Iran. And I thought that maybe I'd use the research to write and record my own shanties based on my experience that I was having on board. But when I got on the boat, it was... the first couple of days were really isolating. There's no, of course, there's no connectivity, or you're limited in your connectivity to the outside world. And so this idea of isolating myself in my cabin and absorbing and then spitting out this material based on research that I had done ashore felt really irrelevant. And then even the sea shanty research felt out of place. So the contemporary vessel and, you know, contemporary merchant vessels or freight vessels don't involve sort of repetitive manual labor of a rowing boat or a steamship that that kind of fueled a lot of the traditional sea shanty context. So the research felt really far from my own experience, and also really importantly, it felt very far from what I said is the general experience of living and working aboard the ships.
That seemed to be a common thing with Sakarnt, actually. She was talking about how she did loads of research before going out and gathering materials and books and downloading PDFs and movies, and it ended up all being irrelevant to her time aboard the ship.
Yeah, I mean, it actually was kind of a relief that way, because I realized that, of course, you know, all the research in the world I can do and I have access to, and research is an important part of my practice, but I often get stuck up on it, and then I get confused about where I'm going with it and whether or not it's sort of delineating from the topic at hand. And so this actual, like, you know, I had committed to an embodied practice by doing this residency. And so I had these 23 days to kind of refine and kind of rejig or recontextualize what I had prepared for, because you can't really prepare for an experience that way. Mm-hmm. But then I had this moment where, I had this small Zoom recorder that I carried on board to record these songs. But instead of recording the songs every day, I was recording ambient sound, because I didn't have anything to fill the SD card with that was kind of coming from my own voice. I mean, there is some tracks of me talking, but mostly just ambient sound of what it sounded like to be on board. I thought maybe I could use that material regardless if I had my wheels turning. But then on the third day we were at sea, they sort of had the crew had this mandatory party. It was like dinner was not served, and instead, in lieu of dinner, you had to go, you didn't have to. In lieu of dinner, they were hosting a party. So if you wanted dinner, you had to go to the party, which meant that it was mandatory. And at the party, it was sort of on my deck, on my floor. And at the party, the crew had brought a karaoke machine, set it up, and were singing karaoke. And it's, I mean, I love karaoke. It's something that I like to do. But then also too, like I found out very quickly that this is kind of one of the primary activities that the crew does when they're not working, which is only on evenings and Sundays basically. So along with like video games and sometimes basketball on Sunday afternoons, karaoke is huge on board. And it seemed that, like it was kind of a moment that clicked where I was thinking, oh, you know, I'm focusing so much on this historical context of songs aboard vessels, but actually there's this whole other realm of singing and singing together and coming together that involve not traditional sea shanty songs or not songs that sort of involve the laboring body, but actually songs that are at leisure and then songs that remind a community maybe of their culture or maybe of their time. So there's a lot of pop songs and Filipino love ballads sung while crossing the Pacific, which I thought was actually really beautiful.
Hmm. Kimberly wrote in her curatorial essay for your logbook about the cultural currency of music aboard the ship and that your work calls attention to the potency of this playing out in the isolated lives of the workers at sea. So how did you see this playing out as a cultural currency? Because in your artist talk at Access a few months ago, you mentioned the sharing of music amongst crew members seeming to function almost like trading a commodity or a piece of cultural capital with one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think that metaphor is really easy for me to make because I was thinking also simultaneously about this sort of mass effort of global trade that involved so much literal freight and material. Like, you know, you're sitting on a boat that's, I think, over 300 meters long, and I would take these walks on the upper deck, which is where the outdoor area where all of the cargo is, and I was thinking about how much material is filling these containers that are being sort of trudged across the Pacific and back every single day. It was felt like really kind of heavy, literally heavy. And then this metaphor of kind of exchanging immaterial sort of media, like songs, but then also music and movies and TV shows all the time between crewmates and then again with me, because I had brought an entire hard drive of my music library like to as far back as high school, which I don't really understand why. Right. I did, but it became really important, like really important for me to connect with them, with the seamen that I shared this super intimate space with. So, you know, everyone liked something different, and I could like, I have all these playlists of, you know, the fourth officer was really into indie music, but didn't have a whole bunch of indie music to choose from. And I had like so much old indie. I mean, I felt really old. He was so much younger than me, but so much old indie music from high school that I shared with him that I think he really enjoyed. And then, I got a lot of Filipino love ballads for Beatles songs. There was one, actually my closest friend on board loved pop country music, which is, you know, circumstantially something that I'm also super into in a guilty pleasure kind of way. So we were like able to share that and then also sort of play it in our cabins and sing along to it together. So, yeah, and then there was actually another really amazing music exchange example is the crew before the Filipino crew. It was a Filipino and French crew that I traveled with. Fidelio was run by a Romanian crew. And so there were Romanian pop CDs and dance CDs everywhere, kind of like stored in different cabinets along the vessel. And so I would collect them and then listen to them for a bit with the Filipinos, but they were dancier. So the Filipinos didn't like them as much. The Filipinos really loved ballads. And Rihanna, which I also was like, Rihanna was really important for me to listen to on board.
Yeah, early on in the recording of Borrowed Time, there's a mention of sea shanty research in Cabin A. So I was thinking, would it be a stretch to think about karaoke as being a contemporary version of sea shanties?
No, I don't think it's a stretch at all. I mean, that's sort of my proposal. It's more sort of my response to myself, thinking about this kind of quite directive project that I assigned myself, and then coming to terms with actually what the project looks like and means in reality, in a reality that I could, there was no way for me to see, but that I was also very naive to or ignorant to before I came aboard. So, yeah, you know, as I said, sea shanties are known for their relationship to the working body, like heaving during the verses and resting at the chorus when the crew is pulling up an anchor, or counting time as the anchor's lowered to measure the depth of the water. But work and life on contemporary freight ships looks so much different than what it used to. So the labor is primarily in the maintenance of this big steel vessel constantly in salt water. So there's endless battle against rust on the exterior and interior of the ship. There's also maintenance of the engine. There's food to cook for all 28 crewmates plus one passenger, and 28 cabins to tidy up and deck hallways to clean. So this type of labor is so much more domestic and so much quieter than the labor that previously had guided the songs that I was researching. Mm. So I found it so much more intimate, and the vessel depended on the crew to stay afloat, and the crew depended on the vessel to stay alive. It was really kind of a specific version of how a group of people managed to live together. And so the leisure time were spent together also doing sort of maintenance and morale. And I think that singing together, singing familiar songs that everyone knew the words to, was sort of like a collective body action when a group sings together.
Yeah, the other work of yours in the gallery, the Two Top Set for One with a Fragmented View, it's a hanging textile work that replicates the screen used to separate the mess hall between the captain's crew and the maintenance crew. So your rendition of it creates a screen in the gallery, and it's made up of old T-shirts that have been used as engine rags aboard the ship. What drew you to this, recreating this screen and doing so in a sort of like soft, dirty fashion?
Yeah, that screen. Oh my God, that screen. I had dreams about that screen. That screen was like, became kind of like a symbol of my experience on board, because it separated I ate in a mess hall with the upper level crew, so sort of the upper level Filipino officers, and then the French captain and the French captain's team. So those were two tables, and then there was my table that was separated in the room by this wooden partition that was also a screen that sort of had this like actually sort of geometric Ming Dynasty style sort of lattice pattern on the top of it, and then it was solid on the bottom, which is also how the curtain is designed. But this screen separated me from all of these people every single mealtime. So like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I sat alone at this table that was covered with a white tablecloth, and the rest of the officers and captains sat at those tables behind the partition. So we were in the same room, but separated with privacy, but with a screen that had allowed, you know, sound to travel, of course. And then we were also able to kind of look into each other's spaces and even sort of speak through the partition if we decided that, if there was sort of a mutual decision that it didn't exist, or if we wanted to ignore it. But it became kind of this symbol of private and public that was sort of like a metaphor for the dual nature of the freight ship and life and work aboard. So that was sort of, I measured it exactly, and then I recreated it in SketchUp. I just wanted to rebuild it to see what its proportions were, and then I started thinking about recreating it. Initially, I thought about remaking it with the exact same material that it was made from, which is just sort of stained reddish wood. But then I found out when I went to visit Fidelio, when they returned to Vancouver after the crossing, after mine, that the engine room used rags that were purchased in bulk from other ports, from other ships carrying bulk textile waste. And previously, before that trip, I had done a lot of research in textile waste and textile like sort of recycling initiatives. Even in Rotterdam here, there's so many companies that are within blocks of my apartment, very close to the port, that pack and distribute textile waste to global buyers. So Fidelio would buy sort of a block of cotton rag, basically, from these types of global suppliers, and the contents would be mostly white, mostly cotton, and used clothing cut at all the seams into sort of flat, manageable-sized rags. So, I mean, the textile industry occupies a large portion of the freight ship industry as well, sort of outside food and natural resources. I thought it was a really beautiful and strange cycle that clothing that would have most likely traveled across the Pacific from east to west, worn by some anonymous body, and then discarded only to find themselves back aboard another ship on the same ocean, but this time being used to sort of like wipe the bellows of the engine and sort of contribute to this maintenance, perpetual maintenance of the vessel, and also perpetual maintenance of the industry the material originally came from. So I thought that seeing graphics on the t-shirts in all different languages, being sort of covered in engine oil, made this made the collection of textiles really kind of intimate and personal, and in close relations to bodies from so many other places. And I thought of my family using our old clothes, you know, my dad's underwear, my mom's t-shirts, my baby clothes, to do our floor cleaning every Sunday. And I thought this was sort of another kind of really domestic gesture of repurposing personal material at an industrial scale. And so I decided to make the curtain out of these rags. So I brought them. I was living on Vancouver Island, and I brought the rags in a big garbage bag, first to two pubs, because they wanted to go to bars in Vancouver after when they came to port the second time. So I took them out to two bars in Gastown. Oh, yeah. I kept at every single bar. I was like, can you put this in your coat check? Or just like to define this like place for this literal garbage bag that reeked of engine oil, really reeked. It reeked way more than it does now because I hadn't cleaned them yet. And then I stayed at poor Kimberly Phillips' house. And then early in the morning, I got on the ferry and traveled back to Vancouver Island again with this huge reeking bag of rags. But yeah, so I was able to make it out of these rags, which I actually think is really nice because it ends up, the rigidity of the form ends up slumping. And the textiles move when people pass them, and you can see behind the quote-unquote front of the piece that there are sort of the tags and the stitch marks of the assembly, which is really important to have as sort of a deconstruction of this partition and of this separation between a private and public space.
Thanks for listening in today. There's 1 week left to come and see the 23 Days at Sea Chapter 2 exhibition at Access Gallery, which ends on October 28th, 2017. Logbooks from each artist that you heard today are available for purchase at the gallery, as well as logbooks from our first round of artists from Chapter 1 of our residency program. This includes Elisa Ferrari, Noor Bashudi, Christopher Boyne, and Amara Rahim. Our next exhibition, Some Spontaneous Particulars, opens December 8, 2017, with works from Vanessa Brown, Haida Hinrichs, and Kathleen Ritter, curated by Kimberly Phillips. I'm Catherine DeMontre, and please come say hi at Access to either myself, our curatorial assistant Chelsea Ewell, or our new director-curator hailing from Halifax, Katie Belcher. We are located at 222 East Georgia in Vancouver's Chinatown, open Tuesday to Saturday, 12 to 5. Plot is a new space at Access Gallery intended for occupation by collectives, artist initiatives, nascent or small-scale organizations, and those conducting itinerant projects who seek space, greater visibility, and most importantly, who desire to cultivate a relationship with a community or public. CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine are the inaugural occupants in the space and will be on-site from September 9, 2017 to February 3, 2018. Access Gallery gratefully acknowledges the support of the BC Government Collaborative Spaces Program and Measured Architecture for making PLOT possible. We also acknowledge the ongoing support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Province of BC, the BC Arts Council, and BC Gaming Commission, the City of Vancouver, and our committed donors, members, and volunteers. One last thank you to the staff at CITR and Discorder Magazine for their collaborative efforts on this project. Look out for Transmissions from Plot in print in Discorder Magazine from now until February 2018.
Hempology 101.